in during this.
Yeah, sure thing, Adnan. Don't worry about it. I'll explain it first to Phyllis, and I think she's still in the hospital, and her friend that she wants to see the DVD has gone off for 2 or 3 weeks in Jerusalem, so she'll just have to be treated to it when she gets back.
Sure. Thanks for letting me know.
Hi, Barry. It's Elizabeth here.
Hello, Elizabeth Woodworth. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. We follow the weather out on the West Coast.
Oh, we follow your weather, too. You've been through a terrible time, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Don't get us talking about it. There's still like 10,000 people out of power here on the eighth day.
And you still got Mayor Ford running everything.
Oh, God. I, you know what? They may take this whole teleconference offline if you mention his name one more time.
Is Jim Fetzer back on the line yet? He said he had a reaction, so I think, well, we could probably get started and, because he won't miss anything critical anyway. We just need to do a few housekeeping things before we get started with Adnan. This is the 9/11/2 special teleconference for 12/29/2013. Craig, you want to take the roll? Call the roll?
Sure. I'll just read off who I know is already on, and if I miss anyone, then you can let me know. I have James Hufford, Lorenzo Fine, Elizabeth Woodworth, Adnan Zuberi, Paul Zaremka, Ken Freeland, Barry Glicker, Craig McKee. And we will have Jim Fetzer, but he's not on yet. Did I miss anyone?
Paul.
If not, that's it.
All right. So just to take care of a few of our normal procedures here, the first thing that we normally do, welcome everybody, of course, and Happy New Year. The first item is to approve the agenda from the previous week. I think I sent it out this time. I'm sorry, the minutes of the previous meeting. I sent them out after the meeting. Any amendments for the minutes from the previous meeting? The hearing none, we'll take those for approved then. Now we'll look at our working agenda for today and make sure that it's okay with everybody. It was sent out as pretty basic today. We don't really have much on the agenda except for, of course, our special guest, Adnan Zuberi. So other than that, we'll just, unless anybody has any item to add.
Ryan?
Robin? Go ahead, Rob.
Yes, I must have become confused. I thought that we were going to have Barbara Honegger do something about that New Jersey lawsuit or explain that a little bit today. That's been postponed.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right about that. That should have been on the agenda, and it wasn't. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. We'll put that first after Adnan. So that will be item number five. And that is...
That's it, Barbara's. I don't think she's on a call, is she?
Well, yes. If she doesn't make the call, then it won't be pertinent anyway. But thank you for recalling that. I should have had that on the agenda. So we'll see if she makes it or not. Okay, and anything else for the agenda?
Well, I just have a technical question, Barry in Toronto. At one point, when I came on, it said there are 9 people on, and then I only caught 8 names. And since then, it still seems to be one person short.
Oh, Barry, it's probably me, Jim Fetzer. I had to drop off. I'm working on an academic freedom conference to be held in Illinois, possibly in March. So I wanted to tape it to share it with those that I'm planning to see if we have some ideas there. I mean, we're recording the conference anyway, but I had to get off and get my Skype reconnected to do the recording.
Well, that explains it. You're one of the most remarkable people to not be on at a given time. The numbers all add up now.
Okay, good, Barry.
If you, when we get to announcements in our regular agenda, can you elaborate on that a little bit for us, on your conference?
Well, I participated in the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference with Stephen Francis in Urbana, which was held a few months ago, and it was such a success. He wanted to move forward with one on academic freedom, focusing on issues like 9/11, JFK, and the Holocaust. So, you know, tentatively, we're looking at March. Kevin Barrett is going to be involved, from the UK, Nick Kohlerstrom, who's done research on the Holocaust and suffered for it. He actually lost a position at University College London for scientific research on whether Zyklon B had been used in gas chambers. James Tracy from Florida Atlantic, who, of course, has done work on Sandy Hook and, become a subject of controversy there. A couple of others. I will come here and make an announcement when we have it formalized.
Great. So right now it's just planned in March sometime. You're not sure when and where.
Right. Well, I was going back over the emails to see if I could find the date, but I wasn't able to nail it down. So.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Okay,
sure.
So I think we're ready to proceed then if there's no further comments on the agenda. Our special guest today is Adnan Zubairi, a filmmaker of 9/11 in the academic community. I hope others other than myself have had the opportunity to view his film. It's certainly worth the $15 price tag. And to introduce him will be James Hufford, who did some of the footwork on preparing this particular teleconference. So go ahead, James.
Okay, well, I just have to admit that the only way that I know Adnan is through the film and a little correspondence that we've had, but going from reading from the online promo, he's an alumnus of Waterloo University, and he's a winner of the University of Toronto Film Festival, and the film explores the taboo that shields the American government's narrative from scholarly examination. The film aims, and I think this is important for us to explore, how if it has achieved anything in this regard. The film aims at challenging intellectual discussion on 9/11 and the war on terror. So that's about all I know to say.
Okay.
Except welcome, Adnan.
Thanks for having me here. I want to thank James, Ken, and everyone who organized this phone call. It's really kind of you, and I think it's an important subject to discuss. Would you like me to start off by generally describing how the film came together, and then...
Yes, if you would, and also please how it's been received. Any comments on that? Okay.
Sure. Okay, so I can discuss like how it came together, and then the types of reviews that I've received from academics. While I was in my undergraduate years at the University of Waterloo, I had the opportunity to engage with many academics. I had the honor of inviting Paul Zaremka, also Barry Zwicker, many such personalities and more academics as well to discuss 9/11. I was running a group called the University of Waterloo 9/11 Research Group, and the purpose of the group was to educate the general public and the university community on critical perspectives on 9/11. With that group, with a couple of grad students, I was able to go and meet with our professors, about 25 to 30 of them in different departments, and discussing this subject with them. I think this documentary basically is the accumulation of all those observations that I was making in the way that I think is perhaps most appropriate to approach academics. When I would go in their offices, I'd book appointments to talk with them. The question really is, how do you bring up the subject of 9/11? It's very difficult. How do you just bring it up? Do you bring it out of the blue? and if you do that, then pretty much the meeting will be over. So I had to really think about it and how to read body language. As soon as you bring up the subject,
you can detect an inflection in, you know, in the atmosphere. It's irreversible. You can see from their body language they don't want to discuss it. And then, so person to person, when it came to meeting at an individual level, the success rate was very low. I realized that out of 25 people, there were about 3 that were open to it. The rest of like the 20, like 22 or so, but pretty much I ruined relations with in some way. So that, even though I tried my best to speak in the most polite way and in a non-controversial way, I think that was the result. The other approach was something like, let's do big presentations, professional presentations, invite other academics to present on the topic, and to invite professors. They usually do not attend any public presentations. It is taboo at the individual level and at the very public level. So, for example, of the 12 conferences that I've done, I could say maybe at most, maybe 1 or 2 academics may show up or none. The rest were just people in the general public, of course. That may have been experienced in other places as well. They don't want to be seen by their colleagues. And one time when we finally did have someone big at the university who tried to grab some of the bigger academics and to get them to a conference to attend a presentation, this one lady who was a professor, who was a part of the Royal Society, and she was a very accomplished academic in structural engineering, she went and she sat in the very corner in the back where the light was dim. Everyone else was sitting at the front. And I think that it's quite telling that there were some forms of failures that I was seeing in these approaches just by the very nature of the taboo. So I realized that there was a need for a private approach, essentially to reduce the entire approach to a practice in language, communication, and in a private attention seeking. That's pretty much what I'm doing here now. So I made the film to instead of discussing evidence, which was quite quite confrontational, and the more evidence we talked about, basically the further they distanced themselves with people in the movement to get a 9/11 investigation going. It was having an adverse effect for some odd reason, even though universities are supposed to be based on evidence, like journals in medical science, for example. This particular topic, by the very nature of it, it was actually causing further distance with them. The more we discuss evidence, the more sociologists see it as, you know, a greater generation in conspiracy discourse. So it was having an opposite effect. So I realized that one can discuss evidence for the last 50, 60 years to the time of JFK and won't get the real attention of mainstream academia. So I started discussing the nature of the taboo itself. And luckily that has worked, just to keep things short. The reviews, so far it's met all the reviews of academics who are new to 9/11. That's what the film is for. It's not really for people who think they know very much about 9/11 already, but it's more for academics who are new to the subject. And it's being making its way into curriculum and has received very good reviews, I'm happy to say.
Adrian, may I ask, what were the disciplines or areas of the faculty with whom you met? Because that can make a huge difference.
Build a stack.
I met with professors in civil engineering, in sociology, in political science. I tried to sample. There are too many departments, right, Jim? But I tried to go to some of the major areas, technical and non-technical, and I think I got a pretty good idea that way.
I would think philosophy, sociology, and anthropology might be more open-minded. But I'm interested. You said that sociologists gave you a critique. Could you reiterate that? I didn't quite catch it. You said the more you talked about evidence, the more conspiratorial you were being?
Generally, if one looks at their publications, and, you know, if you look at the publications and the way they look at 9/11 and things like that, the more evidence people come up with, let's say, in the truth movement, generally, many sociologists, many academics, they just see it as, they don't take it seriously. They never engage at the level of evidence. They don't involve themselves in that discussion. Instead, they look at the effects of these type of discussions, and basically it's done in a very pejorative way. They basically look down upon people who are engaging in any type of truth-seeking. The seed of conspiracy discourse and how it's having a negative impact on democracy and things like that. How these
in other words, they've already been brainwashed into accepting whatever the government tells them about these major events, regardless of the evidence. I mean, that's appalling.
Yeah, they may write publications, for example, that say we're discussing 9/11 and how this has a negative impact on democracy by questioning government officials on 9/11. It's not constructive. It's, you know, that's an example of the many publications out there, and that's it's representative of the conversations I had with them as well. That's their general way of thinking, or they did not want to discuss it at all. So I realized I needed a more private approach, and letting them reflect on these things by watching other personalities, exceptional personalities, discuss the subject. I was happy to interview Paul Zaremka on that. I think he did an excellent job, and I think what was really good about this was the documentary does discuss evidence, but you might think that, but why am I doing that? Because evidence doesn't really work, at least in my experience. But I was trying to discuss evidence in the context of how it's not being discussed. So it was a slightly different approach. It was a bit hard to pull off, but I think it was done just right. And that is able to connect with academics. So it wasn't Paul Zaremka himself making the case that there was a high probability of possible insider trading, but he was discussing how POTUS Mun, how another academic, had published materials, and no one has been responding to him within the field of economics or countering his field. People have supported his results, but no one counters it, despite its implications. The same thing was done in another case study where I was looking at the persecution of John McMurtry, who was one of their
earliest. He's a good man. He's a very good man. Very competent, very accomplished, very well known.
Hero.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was, I think it was just 2 months after 9/11, I documented in the film, that he discussed how, you know, he found no good evidence that the alleged people were behind 9/11. And within just
mean the Islamic terrorists and all that, Osama bin Laden and all that, no evidence to support it.
That's right, yeah, in
yeah.
His study. And so basically you had a lot of academics who were calling for him to be fired. But it went even beyond that. There were one of his colleagues at Harvard, who were very good friends of his, they actually notified him that they're reporting him to the FBI and the CIA.
You're shitting me.
Yeah, and that was the level. That's when I realized that there could be other issues as well. Let's say not 9/11, but some other type of areas where people have a lot of disagreement and may call for the person to, well, this person does not have tenure or is not a serious caller. But this was going at a level far beyond where your own friends report you. For just giving an academic presentation that you were invited to present at the University of Toronto. So once I was discussing how things are blown way out of proportion, any sensible academic who watches the film, that was my general approach, to basically look at how academia has not engaged in this topic properly. And I didn't have McMurtry try to justify himself or to talk about himself. Instead, I had someone else in a greater position who could reflect upon it. I had a former president of a university, and I was happy Barry Zwicker had arranged for that discussion. I was with Walter Pittman of Ryerson University. He's certainly one of the more eminent president emeriti of universities in Canada. And so I had him reflect on it. And so I was taking a very different approach, whereas most other films on 9/11, the person being interviewed, him or herself, is making the case for investigating 9/11, whereas in this film I was trying to take the approach where our interviewees discuss how another person was treated. I wasn't trying to create the impression of objectivity or being distanced from 9/11 itself, but I think it was an approach that we were capable of doing, and it was something I discovered along the way of making the film, which has connected very well with academics, if everyone knows what I mean, kind of.
Yeah. Thank you, Adnan, for that extensive response. I think there are others that want to get in on the conversation here, so what we'll do, since we don't have a pre-registered speaking order this time, is we'll just do a stack as we usually do. So who has a comment or a question for Adnan?
Craig.
Craig, who else?
Elizabeth.
Barry.
Elizabeth.
Tim.
With Robin on the stack, please.
Jim. Barry.
Robin. Yeah, was that Barry?
Yep.
Yeah, Barry. Okay, I had you third. I misspoke. I said Terry, but I meant Barry. Okay. Who else? I have Craig, Elizabeth, Robin. Craig, Elizabeth, Barry, James, and Robin. Okay. So go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, I was just wondering how you feel the academic resistance to the idea of 9/11 being an inside job might compare to, let's say, resistance that we see from the media or from the public in general or from other groups, just in terms of things that might be common to all and maybe some things that are very specific to academia.
When it comes to resistance to the notion of inside jobs, it is generally common. One receives an outright dismissal. And in some sense, I think there is, even though the film points towards it, and that, you know, that there is some type of internal complicity that needs to be investigated, I think there was a difference in languages. I think the way many people in the general public were approaching academics, there was such a difference in language that automatically a person was being dismissed. And I think that it is their fault for being intellectually lazy and timid and all that stuff, but those are not things that they understand. They're seeing us as being people who are kind of like, you know, lunatics, of course, right? So
right.
What I tried to do there to overcome this type of resistance was not to confront it directly, but instead to try to discuss the nature of the resistance or how these thought stoppers work in academic discourse, how there's a suspension of critical faculties. But I didn't want to be so direct where it actually causes them to be distanced again, because they may find it offensive. Neither was I trying to just, keep it so low in controversy that nothing gets done. Things are getting done, and they are responding to it in very good ways, and they're realizing that many academics are, they certainly have difficulties discussing this. So the nature is expected, and I think people in the truth movement can benefit from a change in approach only if their target audience is academics. I think the truth movement does some very good things. Let's say, like, architects and engineers have been successful in getting a lot of engineers to sign on, a lot of practicing engineers. But there's a big distinction between practicing engineers, let's say, who are in the workforce, working for firms and so forth, and academics who are in engineering. There is, you can look at the percentage of people who have signed on AE911 Truth. There are very few. I think there's maybe, I don't think there's a single professor of structural engineering, a current professor of structural engineering, who has signed on. As far as I went through everyone, they may have another professor, let's say, in civil engineering, but his specialty was in environmental areas. And so there is certainly a great taboo there. And part of the reason why I think AE911 Truth has not been successful in actually catering to academic engineering professors is because there is a language difference. They have a language that can appeal to people in the general public, but it does not in any way connect with academics at large in structural engineering, let's say.
Can I do a quick follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted just to bring in the, I guess you sort of touched on this, but whether you learned anything in the process of making this film or in any of your research that might help the rest of us, maybe in terms of how we approach anyone, not only, I mean, most of us, I guess, are probably not starting with academics, but just in approaching other people. I often find I'm not always that successful at that, and maybe that's because I tend to go at it, you know, maybe not as strategically as what I'm hearing you suggest. So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how we could tailor our approach to people from all different backgrounds in terms of getting them to be a little more open and getting some of that information in there before they have a chance to shut down.
Sure. Yeah, that's a very good question. let me just say that when it comes to, let's say, approaching people in the general public, people like Barry Zwicker are, I have a lot to learn from people like Zwicker and yourself. I know Barry Zwicker has been, for many years, so many people know him in Toronto, people of great distinction, and so there's much for me to learn from on that side of things when it comes to the general public. Generally, what I've found when it comes to approaching the academic community, there is an approach that seems to be successful here. There's a communication model in place that I worked out with Professor Graham McQueen, and basically we have what I feel is the highest response rate that we've ever received before. When it comes to, let's say, the general public, we may be giving out, we are doing street activism, we're giving out flyers, we're doing a lot of things. We don't know who we're giving it to, if it's a real person or not. You know, there's no way of measuring activity, progress. None of that stuff really exists. It's a really random, free-for-all approach, just hoping that someone will blow the truth wide open. Instead, what I tried to do here was to, through email, I tried to, basically it was, again, like an exercise in language, and I was trying to connect, and I've come up with an email that connects with academics quite successfully, in that about, let's say, of the last 50 or 60 emails that I've sent to academics, there's about like a 95% response rate.
Wow.
So they all respond back. That's pretty much what I can say. And they respond back in a very good way. I was looking at the way communication was working. And by the way, let me just say that I might be wrong on things. I don't mean to make it look like everything that is being done right, of course, right? Every approach needs continued improvement, and I'm open to that as well. But generally speaking, when we look at the way discourse works around JFK or 9/11 or the Pentagon, it's not that those topics are wrong. There's something real and legitimate about them when it comes to discussing evidence, but it's just that there's a complete disconnection with those things with academics. It becomes counterproductive. So generally, the language that I use in emails, and I can read a little bit off just to give it an idea. To get to something concrete here, I will say something like, you know, dear Professor Zwicker, my name is Adnan Zubiri. I'm the director of a recent award-winning documentary entitled 9/11 in the Academic Community. Given your notable scholarship in the areas of, say, econometrics or you know, options trading, I feel that you are a most relevant and thoughtful person to share the documentary. I originally realized when I would say I would appreciate your review of the film, then they might think that it's a little bit more serious, meaning that the review might be made public, and then we get into the whole repetition of the communication failure, which is they don't want, this is not a subject by its very taboo nature, to be resolved in a public way. So they may come up with, so very early on they had an excuse saying, well, I really want to watch it because of the way it seems to be, what the things it's discussing, but I'm not sure if I'm a qualified reviewer. Then, you know, again, the speciality starts having a difficulty. So then I had to improve upon the wording and say I want to share it with you because I believe them to be a thoughtful and relevant person. That has made the response rate even higher, almost a perfect response rate. So every time I shoot the email, I get an email back within 24 hours if they want to watch the film. And they trust the communication. They're okay and comfortable with responding back by going on email record, by not even thinking that's an issue, because there's a comfort in language and trustability that this will be done, you know, confidentially or within the circle of just the filmmakers. And then I describe the film by saying, the film, through notable personalities such as, so this, you know, President Emeritus of this university or this distinguished academic who has quite an international reputation. The film documents academia's treatment of critical perspectives on 9/11 by exploring impairments in professional inquiry. The film does indeed discuss impairments in professional inquiry. I took an example of Chomsky. By not repeating most of the truth movement's arguments with Chomsky, but just by looking at Chomsky's own literature and just leaving it at that, and that pretty much takes care of Chomsky. anyone who watches it, Chomsky is basically saying in his book, in his bestseller to 9/11, that you know, even the anthrax was localized to U.S. government weapons laboratories. The evidence against the so-called hijackers was very little. But let's presume the official story is correct. So just by within 10 seconds, the film handles Chomsky and convinces academics, I think quite successfully, that there are something called impairments in professional inquiry. There are certain weaknesses or presumptions that are not interrogated, in that it's a phenomenon that pervades pretty much all of political science when it comes to definitions and textbooks and so forth. So it explores impairments in professional inquiry, which are sociological. These are terms used in sociology and in some political science where some professors who were critical of their own discipline at Yale University, I'm talking about Charles Lindbloom here, who was the former president of the American Political Science Association, he was noticing how all these definitions are so naive. And there's no, it's like they're taken as axioms without any justification. So I took this wording from his book, and he's aware of that, impairments in professional inquiry. And this connects well to, let's say, professors of sociology that I'm talking with. We're speaking the same language here. So finally, we're on the right train track then. It explores the ethical and epistemological implications of basing the 9/11 official narrative on torture testimony. So for philosophy professors who are interested in ethics and epistemology, which is, James Fetzer would probably know most about this, you know, the theory of the foundation of knowledge and what constitutes knowledge and so forth. So we're using, I think, words that are not just academic, but they're understandable, and they're actually representative of the film itself. And so that's an example. I hope I've tried to give some concrete example of the wording here, if one is to approach academics.
Great. Thank you very much, Edgar.
You're welcome.
Thank you. This is Ken. I'm going to add myself to the stack after Robin. Does anybody else who hasn't spoken yet want to be added to the stack? Okay. Thank you. Elizabeth, you were next.
Yes. Adnan, I think you've done a wonderful job of communicating. Very intelligent and perceptive approach. There's some good news about 9/11 academic films on the horizon. In the wake of Massimo Mazzucco's landmark film, which is now being seen by 250,000 people, Matthew Kasovitz, the French director, who you all probably know of, he's been hailed as the heir to Truffaut, as the, I guess, second most excellent French film director. He's also an honorary member of our consensus panel. And he's just announced that he plans to undertake his own film about 9/11 after he saw it. He's been thinking about it for some time. And after he saw how Massimo's film did, I think it's given him encouragement. Also, Ken Jenkins is going to do a film specifically about the 9/11 consensus points that we've developed. There's 37 of them now, and that'll be an academic approach. So I'm thinking that with actually four films now that are kind of geared towards evidence-based 9/11 approach, that we might be able to do some kind of a publicity about a group of films that mutually support each other. And that's just what I wanted to sort of interject, to give you the news about the other films that are being made of the same type of quality, and figure out if there might be a way to for them to, when you go to other academics, to actually include these other films that are on the horizon.
Thanks so much for that good information. And I think that's an article that can kind of describe this entire, approach or disconnection with intellectuals in 9/11 is much needed, that describes all these films. And I remember, Elizabeth, you have some amazing writing skills. I think it was because of you that, you know, things like the Toronto hearings survived and got a little bit of international attention. So kudos to you for all that.
Well, I did a little tiny bit of that, but you and Graham and others certainly, it was a fine event. It was excellent.
Yeah. I think that generally when it comes to events, my general observation has been that there are events that everyone in this conversation has been involved with that are of some academic nature, in, to one extent or to another. For example, like the Toronto hearings, for example, that we did, we had a lot of professors attend. We published a full report. It, a lot of energy got put into it. This is just an example of many conferences that happened. A lot of energy, we've all spent a lot of energy on these things, but that entire 9/11 Toronto hearings report, I don't feel that it's kind of direct when it comes to evidence, because the mandate of the hearings is quite some time ago. I can't remember those, all the goals that we were trying to accomplish. It was quite a bit, actually. But basically, we're trying to look at evidence that disproves the official narrative, and we're trying to get some media attention. We're trying to assess, will the media even respond? We could have the whole, let's say, truth of 9/11, but will it really make any difference at the public level? And the answer that I seemed to get out of it was they run a newspaper. They ran two articles, let's say the National Post and the Globe and Mail, and they said that this conference is happening. And then they revert back to the language of the dominant official narrative the very next day at 7 a.m. and they're reporting on back to good old Al-Qaeda again. And so basically things like these are handled in a way that, oh, these anomalies happen once in a while. There's a group in the general public. Let's do a little small story on them, but we'll keep the language the same generally. So my feeling is that with the Toronto hearings, even though I was behind that big effort, it may help with the general public in connecting with them with that language, and the general public is a little bit more comfortable with discussing evidence. But I don't think, if we are talking about academics, I don't feel that these massive energies are going to gain a lot of traction in language and in connection with academics, has been my thinking. But perhaps you may have some further thoughts on that, Elizabeth.
I don't know. I think what's connecting with the general public right now is this 28 pages of information that was left out of the congressional report in 2002. That's been covered by almost every major mainstream outlet in the U.S. in the last 10 days, saying that, you know, Saudi Arabia had a hand in this and they financed the hijackers. That much seems to have been... I've been watching this very carefully on Google News and tweeting about it. And it's that kind of a thing that's going to erupt into the general public. You know, Saudi Arabia paid for this. How come we didn't know this? And where else does this lead? This is what's being spoken about. But the academic work is what the public can, and the journalists can fall back on. The work we've been doing all this time will one day, soon, I hope, suddenly become relevant to everybody, that there's this actual academic community that's been working on this for 12 years. And now we have now that the foot in the door is actually open in the media, will suddenly come into prominence. That's what I think will happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very optimistic. Next is Barry.
Speaking of optimism, I've been having some discussions, both oral and in emails, with a few people on the subject of hope. And it's a fascinating subject. You know, how soon might we expect, or even should we expect, a breakthrough, to use a term that comes up from time to time, in the matter of 9/11 truths? And how would we define a breakthrough? So that's a whole subject of itself. A couple of brief comments, and then I actually have, I guess, two questions for Adnan. First comment is that I don't know how many others on this line have noticed this, but it really is in connection with the strategy of tension that is being practiced clearly worldwide by the American Empire and its enablers such as Israel. And so they have to have this all-purpose demon to completely replace the, quote, specter of communism. And with communism, you may remember, you always had to have a bulwark against communism. And so Al-Qaeda fits the bill, no matter that the media don't go into the background of how what Al-Qaeda is, when it was invented, and so forth. And the point I want to make is that I've noticed, and I do, it's not a matter of pride, I guess, exactly, but I do read at least two newspapers fully every day, plus the online information that I access. And I've noticed a new phrase has come up, and that is, it used to be linked to Al-Qaeda, or believed to be linked to Al-Qaeda. And now the phrase that's popping up, especially with Associated Press, a highly suspect organization, is inspired by Al-Qaeda. My God, inspired by Al-Qaeda. So anyway, that's one comment. The second one is that I can't share, I'm afraid, with Elizabeth that these 28 redacted pages are other, may I say, than disinformation. It's a redirection of attention away from what I take as the realities of the terror or fraud of 9/11. Now, my questions for Adnan first are to do with the disease of specialization. And I first encountered the idea that this deserves to be called a disease was in the work of Wendell Berry back in the 1980s, I think. Wonderful American author. There's this old saying that an expert is someone who knows more and more about less and less until he knows everything about nothing. And the opposite is the now trite, but still extremely central and important, connecting the dots. And so, number one, I'd love to hear Adnan comment further about this disease of specialization, which is also addressed by Charles Lindbaum in the book that Adnan mentions, which I obtained, and although it's out of print, and I'm partway through it. So that's number one, disease of specialization. Now, the second one is about a particular individual named Pinker. Now, you emailed me, Adnan, about Steven Pinker, and mentioned Pinker favorably at some point, and that's true. I had, because I was so impressed with his work, especially about language and thinking. I mean, these are really central, language and thinking, and how do you separate them for that matter. And I gained from your email that you plan to send your DVD to Steven Pinker along the lines with the kind of intro that you mentioned to see how he would respond. And so I responded to you, as you'll recall, my shock and dismay, because Puzzlement even wouldn't cover it, when I bought Pinker's 2007 book, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature, and read as the first words of Chapter 1, quote, on September 11, 2001, at 8:46 a.m., a hijacked airliner crashed into the North Tower, and I would just say blah, blah, blah. Was this an intriguing come on? Well, the second paragraph says, quote, 9/11 has set off debates on a vast array of topics, whether the attacks are rooted in ancient Islamic fundamentalism or modern revolutionary agitation. The role of the United States on the world stage before the attacks and in response to them, and how best to balance protection against terrorism with respect to civil liberties. And it goes on and gets worse. So in other words, Steven Pinker, who's just a mountainous intellectual, has completely accepted the official story of 9/11 and has actually built a book about the nature of thought on that totally diseased basis. So I was kind of glad to see your email response, which was, quote, I'll take care of Pinker. I thought that sounded a little mafia-like. But anyway, I wonder if you have comments on those two things, Adnan. First, the disease, and second, Steven Pinker as such.
Oh, boy. Barry, I want to thank you for asking me the hardest questions of all. I'll definitely pay you back to a bear hug when I meet you. I think that let me try to discuss those two things and also try to pick up from what Elizabeth last said about the so-called classified papers regarding the possible involvement of Saudis. I'm kind of at a middle ground between whether it's a redirection of the strategy of tension and whether there may be, of course, some type of sponsor in getting these so-called alleged hijackers to be a part of some type of military exercise. And these people may have been received in the U.S. through some type of Saudi support who weren't really aware of what they were being involved for to the full extent. But whatever the case may be there, it's difficult for us to, of course, determine what the case really is because we don't have access to all the information there. But one way to try to get into mainstream discourse is Paul Zaremka has been quite very, very helpful in terms of reaching out to his university and to reaching out to the Real News Network. I think everyone here is familiar with that one. And they are reviewing the film now. And as we know, recently the Real News Network interviewed Senator Bob Graham, who was the chair of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, the mainstream media is very well aware of keeping separate truth or discourse and, you know, and the information coming from, let's say, senior senators. They keep them separate. So just when you think the media is about to, you know, blow open something really big when it comes to 9/11, they don't, right? it almost borders it, but then they don't, right? And they never allow, just like with the anthrax attacks, even we discovered that, you know, it's coming from our U.S. bioweapons laboratories, there's cut off to the level of questions. It just doesn't go, and it just kind of just fades away. So we can generally anticipate that that's going to happen with this as well. But one way to get through is that we have a professor who has served as a senior on the U.S. Senate Select Intelligence Committee. He's reviewing it, reviewing the film, and hopefully he'll endorse it as well. I'm able to get reviews. Maybe some may not be wanting to endorse it, but they write informally that they really like the film. So at least with regards to that, once you have this, we need some foundations here. We can't just approach people right away and expect them to discuss things the same way we do. We need to get other experts in their field slightly lower down and working in a pyramid fashion and in endorsements, which is really a tool of getting higher and higher up and influencing academics to rethink this subject. And then slowly we can make our way to Bob Graham and so forth. There's another former deputy director of the White House Task Force for Terrorism, who's reviewing the film as well. So we work with a foundation of people to approach other people and so forth. And I think I'm trying to try this behind the alley type approach rather than a very public approach, and just trying to multiply the model now to get through. Now, with regards to what Barry is saying on regards to the disease of specialization, let me just comment on that by talking about how John McMurtry has analyzed that the discipline is, in a sense, trying to push you forward and making new connections, and at the same time, it's trying to stop you from making connections that are outside your specialization. And so it's sometimes a bit of a paradoxical relationship. You might get awards for doing interdisciplinary work, but then at the same time, you might be causing some people some grief, some other experts, because you're not an absolute expert in that field. There was one lady professor at the University of Guelph, John McMurtry, had to help. She was a professor of biology, and she made a comment about genetics, but her specialty was slightly something different, like plant anatomy or something like that. And because she wasn't a geneticist, the dean called her immoral, and the word went around the whole department, and it was just a very sad thing. And the women already have it very difficult in the sciences and universities in terms of all the pressures and so forth, and differences in small differences in salary and so on and so forth. So These things happen when it comes to specialization, and I think one way to counter that, at least at a concrete level with regards to the film, is that when I email some professors and I notice that they are, let's say, in economics, then I will tend to choose, then I will describe some of the endorsements from economists. If I'm approaching university presidents, there are a couple who are reviewing the film right now as well. It takes about like 4 to 6 weeks to get back. They're very busy people. Then I will mention other university presidents who have endorsed the film. So I think there is a disease of specialization. It's expected, and we have to try to work with it by telling there are others who have kind of gotten over that disease of specialization. The second thing was with regards to Steven Pinker. And I feel that, yes, there are.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Somebody in the background is doing a lot of like coughing, sneezing, and there's static coming too. If that's you, if you press *6, others won't need to hear it, and then you can press *6 when you want to talk again. Thank you so much. I'm sorry, Adnan, go ahead.
Okay. When it comes to people like Steven Pinker, let me... hello, Barry?
I'm here.
Oh, yes. Okay, so Barry, perhaps we can respectfully differ a little bit on this. I know you and I have had a lot of good conversations about everything, and I think that where we can differ is where I believe that this is all expected. When one is in mainstream academia, when one is kind of, you know, you're brought up in those corridors and things like that, it is a very nice place, and they do promote a lot of freedom of inquiry in a lot of areas, but there are certain types of topics that critical thinking is being entirely suspended, and we all expect people like Chomsky and Pinker and all these people to be critical of these things, but just by the very nature of the institution and how discourse works, it kind of orients these axioms upon them. I'm not trying to defend them, but we can kind of understand why things are the way they are in the atmosphere that they're in. And so we need to kind of find a way to work in that discourse. None of the wording I use supports the official story, but it's still able to get through. I don't know if it'll get through to Pinker, but hopefully it will. And so let's see. I do want to say one thing that I just got back. I believe I emailed you the updates of the film. Keith Spicer, who is Canada's first commissioner of official languages, he was a professor of political science at Dartmouth, UST, UCLA, and a lot of places, and he's been awarded like the highest merit in Canada and so forth. And he wrote a very lengthy book about the War on Terror, and he did the same thing Steven Pinker does. And these people are not exceptional. There's thousands of academics that presume the official story to be correct, and they may embellish the official story in the introduction of their books or somewhere in the middle of their books. And I'm saying that this is expected just by the very nature of how they're brought up in institutions and how they see things, certain axioms. So we don't need to be too surprised or to be dismayed by that, but instead to see how we can work with it. He saw the film, Professor Spicer. He's teaching right now at the UN University. He's their founding director of their Peace, Conflict, and Security Studies program. He wrote back to me saying that, thank you for sharing it. This is the most interesting piece of work. The word interesting is kind of interesting. You know, they don't want to say they fully agree. They don't have any way of disagreeing. But basically, it's a type of thing by saying, you know what, I can't ridicule this anymore. I can't just say this stuff is nonsense. The subject has still made some level of improvement. And hopefully we'll catch a big fish as we keep exploring through. There were other academics, one who is now a dean at the University of Waterloo. Again, the individual approach completely flopped. When I talked to him, he said no, Al-Qaeda was behind this and this and that. Again, the same Steven Pinker stuff all over again. It's pervasive among all academics generally, it's expected. But he saw the film, and I have a lot more respect for people who turn 180 degrees around, meaning they make one statement, but they have the courage, and they don't take it as an insult to their dignity by saying that they were wrong or something. But I've had now at least two cases now with academics. I went back to that dean. An employee of the university, a lady, gave him the professor. By the way, the film looks, it's done. Luckily, the cover was made in a very professional way, with endorsements over with the Film Festival Award and so forth. It doesn't look conspiratorial. He watched it, and he actually wrote back an email saying that this was an excellent piece of work. He watched it with his wife, and he's open to discussing it now. So the film does have an unusual potential to turn people who had made definitive statements in one way and be possibly open to now reconsidering their entire thoughts on it. So Steven Pinker is just one of many people. I wouldn't rely on him. We have many more foundations to build with a larger number of academics in the background who don't get attention. So that's my approach to that, Barry.
Could I just respond very, very, very briefly?
Sorry.
I'm kind of sorry, Adnan. I agree with you that we can agree to disagree. We must agree to disagree, and this is the way forward to through tolerance and mutual respect and so forth. I couldn't agree with you more. But I'd say in a lighter note that I'm almost sorry that when you emailed me, "I'll take care of Pinker," that you didn't mean more, I'm going to hire a couple of guys to break his kneecaps. Because I think that your approach has enabled you to enjoy the success on behalf of all of us and on behalf of 9/11 Truth and on behalf of interdisciplinary discourse in general. Your approach, your personality, the person you are, and the intellectual structure that you've built on and around your personality is wonderful, and it has enabled much of the success, if not all of the success that you've enjoyed. And at the same time, I have a darker outlook on Steven Pinker and Noam Chomsky, probably. But I think, your approach is working, and I won't argue with that at all.
I agree. I support that. I second that.
Thank you all for embarrassing me. So thanks for the kind comments. I appreciate that.
You can put me on the list if you want. I wanted to add to this when we get
Okay. Next is James Fetzer.
Okay.
Oh, great. Okay, already. Well, Barry mentioned it in passing.
James, I beg your pardon. I misspoke. It was James Hufford who was next.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, that's good, because I just got shunted off the call and just got back just now. So anyway, I wanted to say that.
Were you bounced, James, or did you just leave the call?
I just got a dial signal all of a sudden and had to redial and get back on.
I had to do the same thing, actually.
It sounds like our Canadian colleagues are having considerable technical problems with this teleconference. Something we'll have to keep in mind.
Well, I hope we aren't being tampered with.
Ha-ha. Go ahead, James.
Okay, well, let's see. I kept collecting more and more thoughts as the conversation went along, but first I'd like to say that I think that memos have gone out to people that are considered to be the leading literati, not literati, but Illuminati to giving them tidbits and, keeping feeding them tidbits from inside and also giving them guidelines on how they're conduct their writings and so on, what they say. And then I wanted to collaborate with Adnan some of his experiences. When Richard Gage was coming to our area, I tried to get him into an auditorium at Iowa State University, which is a big technical school, and I specifically tried to they have a major architectural college there, and I tried to get him into the auditorium at that college, and we went to talk to the dean, and we just we just ran into a stone wall. We couldn't get him anywhere on campus and had to go to Ames City Auditorium, which isn't connected with the university. And anyway, we put up flyers everywhere in those departments, in the technical departments, and we may have gotten one or two individual students or faculty from those departments, and that is absolutely all. We just got completely stonewalled, and we're, you know, just so surprised at that. But I think that probably what happened was that somebody went around just as soon as we put up our flyers and just took them all down. I don't know. But that was our experience.
May I ask your name? You just mentioned this really good experience. Can you say your name again?
I'm James Hufford.
James Hufford, right. Sorry. You're the one who organized all this, too. Okay.
Yeah.
James, that's been my experience as well. I organized many good conferences as well. A lot of posters went up. A lot of them got ripped down, and very few people came out. But and I think that there is something good to feel about here. So let's say invitations went out to, let's say, like 50 academics, and we did a lot of outreach, the best, you know, you and I could try to do, and hardly anyone showed up from the relevant community. Mm-hmm. And even if they were to come out, those two people are not in a position to do much about it because larger institutional pressures, the language isn't there to really express dissent or critical thinking on these foundational levels of
well, let me just say this. I think that those people I'm an academic myself. Those people understand English. They may have their own language that they speak to each other, but they understand English, and I don't think you're going to increase comprehension a bit by using some specialized shibboleth with them. They know what you're saying, and they know how to translate it into academic speak too, if they're so inclined. But I just don't think they're willing. They know better, let's put it that way. And rightfully so. I believe that I lost teaching positions on three campuses myself from my 9/11 truth activism. So, you know, I think that there are enough examples that people know to keep their head down on this.
You want to respond to that, Anna?
Oh, right. No, I generally agree that, yeah, they do understand English, and I definitely agree with you that they do have a sense of what you're saying, and some of them may even have a sense of what you're talking about is actually true, and that there's something important about it. And it's just the foundations within the institution are not present for them to respond back, at least by showing up in public at a conference and things like that. When it comes to the email or letter approach, even then, intellectuals have never really responded. The people that one would expect to be engaged on this, for, let's say, like all of academia, where were they when it comes to, you know, many major issues in the past? I think when it comes to a particular type of language that they can connect to and respond back with, is something that we can benefit from. And if you were to instead invite, not invite, but have the consideration of those academics in a private manner, not to show up anywhere in a public venue, they would be, I think, much more likely to respond. Has been my experience, and so I know there's a lot of letdowns, but I think there is something good to feel about that we can move forward in a positive way, and I can try to share some of the examples of how we can continue connecting with intellectuals.
We can certainly try, that's for sure.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Robin, you're next.
Yeah, and thank you for your work. I'm going to kind of break my questions and my position here and presentation here into two groups, and I mean no insult. One group is highfalutin,
The other group is lowfalutin. I do my work lowfalutin, which is with the people. But this academic community DVD you had is really good for reaching what I have to say is a small segment of our society. But I'm interested in one question, then I'll give you a breakdown of what I do and how I think you can be much more successful at getting your reach out accomplished. The question that I would have, Adnan, is you said that you have done some work in trying to organize and educate and engage two basic groups. One is sort of the general public, and then you've gone and explained very well you're trying to reach out to the academic community. It's not the it's the comparison in what you might have learned from your reach out to the general public, which is what I do all the time, and you could share with me possibly what differences you found that worked in the general public that you reached out to. And you could define that. Is it a local campus town? Is it just or is it just general random public operations? So could you just briefly say what you've found different between those customer bases, let's call it that way?
Okay, so I may not have been able to hear you. I was having some difficulties with my phone there. But you're asking about the approach to the general public and the general results that I found in terms of, like, outreach with them. Is that right, Robin?
That is correct. And in comparison specifically to what you've already said, which is with the academic community. You've made that clear. Everybody's made that clear. That's the highfalutin community. I'm talking about the lowfalutin community, which is just the general public. What differences did you find in what worked and didn't work? I mean, I already have I have a wealth of information myself. I'm just trying to get what you've discovered.
Sure. Okay. So I think, Robin, there are many people like Barry Zwicker and almost everyone in this conversation has engaged at, in a level with the general public no different than I have. Generally, what I found was that, in my own view, and I may be wrong on this, I generally feel that the general public is quite paralyzed on this subject. You know, it's very difficult to make advances on this subject because they're starved of any type of mainstream media attention. There are approaches that tend to be productive to some but end up being counterproductive to others and in the audience of general people. We may have a growing grassroots movement. It's generally not that fast. It's still quite slow. I found that whenever I try to work with the general public, and I'm a part of the general public, I'm not an academic at all. I mean, I think there are some very good qualities about the general public, much better than academics, in their ability to attend conferences courageously and to take part in the active dialogue. I really like that about the general person. But there is sometimes a lack of professionalism, a lack in consistency and approach. When accumulated together, made it very difficult for me, at least in what I observe in terms of results, to continue working with them in different ways. I mean, I'm still involved with them, but I think that there are approaches that have major limitations. They work really well with certain groups, but not with other groups. Right? I find that with the academic community, it is a very small segment, and you're absolutely right about that. Why spend so much energy on academics when they're such a small portion of society? I think they are important.
Don't say that. I'm glad that you're doing that. I'm just saying it's a small portion. That's
yeah,
all.
Yeah. Oh, of course. No, I fully understand what you mean. And let me say that it is indeed a small portion of society, but they're very important because if we think about it, Philip Zelikow, he himself is actually, he has the title, maybe Paul Zremka might remember, he's a distinguished professor of history right now, and he's also the Dean of Graduate Studies at Virginia, University of Virginia. And these government officials, they usually don't write, you know, 600-page reports themselves. They always kind of get academic consultants to do that work. It's academics that it always comes down to in many ways. So they got Zelikow to do it. He's an academic, right? It's very important. If you look at, for example, Martin Heidegger, maybe Jim Fetzer, who's a philosophy professor, would know this very well. Martin Heidegger was a professor, an eminent professor of philosophy. He laid one of the foundations for existentialism, or did a lot of pioneering work in it. And he had a lot of intellectual command and influence in Germany. So at the very time the German people were having doubts about the sophistication and intellect of the Nazi Party, right at that moment, within becoming president of the University of Friedenberg, within just 2 weeks of becoming president, or rector, is the word they use over there, he announced his support for the Nazi Party. It sent a wave of intellectual legitimization for the Nazi Party and facilitated their entry into academia and started imposing, you know, restrictions on academics, advancement, and on the career ladder only if they identified themselves with the party. So in many historical contexts, when governments can be quite oppressive, there are many major academics that play a role, even though they are a very small portion of society. And I feel that's still applicable to today's time, where even though the New York Times has in front of them a big billboard saying, you know, there's so many architects and engineers, why won't you discuss the subject? If they've already made a decision, as we know, on C-SPAN, that they will not be engaging with that subject, but if there was a miracle and we went one level further in the debate, all they have to do is call a professor at MIT in engineering, and just write one article that says, here are these type of architects and engineers, a couple of them, they won't even quote them properly, then here's an MIT professor. And just by stating the word MIT, there's a presumed victory, and now we've already covered that issue, now we can get on with, you know, tomorrow 7 a.m., normal reporting from there on, they've covered the issue. And so academics play a very major role, and by getting into these, so I think it's a very important group of people to have an impact on. And I've had good results in the sense that people who often watch the film consider it to be played in class. So there was a chair of structural engineering at a university in Ontario who showed it to his third-year civil engineering class. I'm happy to say that I received a perfect review, and now it's permanently in their curriculum now. Same with some universities in Florida. They're shown in their media studies class. Perfect review. And Paul Zremke's friend, a very good sociologist at the University of Western, in his classes on the sociology of terrorism, showed it in class. Perfect response. It's in curriculum. Three ladies at U of T in the same department at the University of Toronto, they saw it, and now they're fully involving it in their curriculum. So for the first time, we're actually able to get into curriculum, actually having a difference in how knowledge is presented, and slowly making those foundations there. It will be a long-term approach. If I keep sticking with this private model, you can give me another 300 years to live, and I won't be able to reach more than a couple academics. If I want to keep it private, what I'm doing is I'm going to multiply the model to some good friends and sending out letters, DVDs, and by targeting certain academics and presidents, and that's how we're hopefully going to have that influence. We got the endorsement from the former director of the CBC. I don't know if you folks may have heard, the CBC has made some films on 9/11 that weren't very good. It's the Canadian Broadcasting Commission. It's like the equivalent of the CNN or so in Canada, at least. So we just got their endorsement 2 weeks ago. So.
Wow.
Who was that, Adnan? Which director?
It was Paul Allman. You may have heard of him. He's a very accomplished person. He was an award-winning director of the CBC.
Wow.
And he directed over 100 films for the CBC. The Toronto Star called him perhaps the best director the CBC has had. And he's an officer of the Order of Canada and to the Royal Canadian Academy of Arts. So he's helping me with connecting with Hollywood actors, but I don't know if I want to go in that direction.
Well, okay. Well, thank you for that answer. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting, and I'm not dismissing the value of the 9/11 consensus. It's very, very, very important. I'm not dismissing the value of reach out to academia. And the highfalutin is academia and the news media, and it's a hard thing to break through. Yes, we got to keep going after it. I'm just on the phone call and sharing some information with you that I've collected because I am still in the streets with large signs and handouts between one and three times a week here around the Puget Sound. And I find the way that I have put my presentation together, which is to commingle 9/11 truth for world peace, okay, because that's what it's, to me, that's what the only value of 9/11 research is. It really actually resonates very, very well. I've developed a paper called Civil Informationing. Canadian Doug Brinkman up in Edmonton calls it CIA. I can't do that, Civil Information Activism. And the concept is what the 9/11 Truth community used to do at the 11th of every month. But Cosmos pulled out of that program as soon as we focused on Larry Silverstein in the World World Trade Center buildings. So that wasn't by accident that that whole program was dismissed. That was by design, except for I keep on doing it, okay? And I reach a lot of good people and have some fine conversations with very large science. I go to major sporting events and other major, major intersections and places where people in high-volume vehicles are, and I just have some information that just plants seeds and does well. Now, another thing that I did, okay, is I put together a DVD myself, okay, and I call it The Path to Peace. And I buy a jacket, and I put the word free on its stickers and stuff like that, and I go around and I do a process called pushpin. I call it my pushpin tactic. I take these DVDs. I'm into my second thousand now. Oh, I think I'm beyond 2,000. Self-funded is just what I do. And what I do is I take a handful of pushpins, and I find a dozen or two places in my normal routes where I am in my local area. Okay, and I will go and I will find bulletin boards and I'll find places where people post things up, and because it doesn't shout 9/11 truth or, you know, conspiracy or anything like that, it has the word free on it, the DVD's name through the jacket is A Path to Peace, and I pin them up. And they go really very well. It's very encouraging because when I run back to the same location, somebody has taken them, okay? And this is the good thing. The most important point that covers everybody, especially in the academic community and in the public at large, and I accept the mainstream media from this because they've been directed to ignore this, but it's cognitive dissonance. It is a attack on one's belief structure in all of these spheres. It's covered beautifully in The Architects and Engineers Experts Speak Out, Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out. The psychologists have done a great service for us. So this is what I have found. I have found that the best way to have a conversation with the public about the 9/11 truth is not to have a conversation with them at all. I just present my information. If somebody comes up to me and wants a conversation, I give it to them, and I take my little DVDs wherever I am, and I hold them in my hand to be taken away, or I push pin them on trees and telephone poles and wherever it might be, and they go, and it's really great. It's my view is that 9/11 truth is a people's movement, and I want to just talk. Fetzer knows a lot about this, okay? But I want to talk and correlate the JFK situation with 9/11. Something like 85% of the people in this country really believe that JFK was assassinated by elements within our own government. And I don't want to say which is right or which is wrong. But you don't find people running up and down the street saying, "The government killed JFK. The government killed JFK." They know it. They got it inside. They've done their research. They've done it on their own time. So this push-pin tactic, which is really an admission that if you confront people publicly about the 9/11 facts and data, they're going to withdraw. They are going to. There are so many forces to make them hide from sharing conversations with you. So if we can just slip it in and let people take it, and if you had DVDs that didn't shout, okay, 9/11's inside job. If you had DVDs structured like mine does, a path to peace, okay? And while I'm on that, let me tell you what that DVD has. I have, since Architects and Engineers removed Larry Silverstein inappropriately, I start the DVD up. It's 2 hours long. It's a Bowman 3 minutes on World Trade Center 7, 60 minutes of explosive evidence, experts speak out, Press for Truth 15 minutes, Dancing Israelis, False Flag and Black Ops, USS Liberty, Gulf of Tonkin, Pearl Harbor, PNAC, Intercept Protocols, Anthrax, and Rachel Corey. I get more information out like that. And then when people, I'm almost done. When people take the DVD and then they see me again, they come over to me and they shake my hand and say, thank you for this. This is wonderful because I didn't approach them straight on. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. This is Ken. I wanted to first say, Adnan, that how impressed with your film and how it evidently has settled itself already into the canon of 9/11 truth filmography. But I wanted to point out a couple of things that I think you've mentioned in passing that it's worthwhile remarking on. The first one has to do with your approach of using others in the field of the people that you are talking about, their endorsements or their perhaps past positive comments or whatever, as a way of finding an entry into particular academic circles. And the technical term for that in marketing or in public relations is ethos. And I think it's something that is very useful, and I think you've shown an excellent example of how to employ ethos in the process of promulgating alternative information by doing that, showing by listing the people who have already given past approval to what you're doing, I guess you would say. And secondly, I think that your film focuses, especially in the latter part, on the notion of academic responsibility. And I think that this is something to which even those who are not convinced directly about 9/11 feel a responsibility to. There's something, I think it wakes something up in the serious academic that, well, whether or not I agree or disagree with the point here, he's got a point about academic responsibility, and doggone it, how come this thing is being treated anomalously, you know, and so forth. So I think in that respect, the film is dynamic. I think it really does have a way of penetrating academic resistance because it gets to a deeper principle at stake here than just the question of 9/11. I wanted to ask you two questions. The first one's pretty quick. If you could just list which awards the film has won, and then I'll ask you the second question.
Oh, sure. Can I just have your name again? Sorry.
I'm Ken Freeland, facilitating the conference.
Ken, right?
Yes, Ken.
Okay, sorry. This my phone is of a very low quality. Thanks, Ken, for your kind remarks regarding the film. With regards to the awards that the film won, I did not engage purposely in film festivals. I just engaged in one. It was just the University of Toronto Film Festival, and I'm happy that it was awarded for Documentary Achievement, was the exact title of the award from the University of Toronto Film Festival and their film board. So I was happy that they did that. The problem with engaging in too many film festivals is that they have different deadlines and conflicting requirements. So, for example, one film festival, which was quite major, was saying that the film must not have been shown anywhere in public setting or anywhere else in the world. And you have to wait several months until, you know, basically there were, it's more for filmmakers who are looking for really getting their name out, let's say in magazines or certain types of awards, and they have a lot of benefits. I agree, there's lots of benefits. But there are benefits being bestowed upon by people in the general public, and academics may not really be, certain academics may not care very much if you've won film festival awards. I thought it was more important to spend time engaging, after winning one award, spending time engaging university presidents and stuff like that. And after having two or three of their endorsements, which we now have, that has a better effect.
I think having a university film festival under your belt, again, leads back to the ethos that makes it easier for academics to be open to your film. The second question I had was something you said earlier in response to someone else. You said that you think that academics generally don't want to see this issue resolved in a public way. Could you elaborate on what way you think they do want to see it get resolved? I mean, how would that be described?
Okay, so I think that's a very good question. My general observations were, as I had described early on in the conference call here, that because it is taboo, they don't want to be publicly involved in this type of subject. They don't want to be seen by their colleagues and so forth. And so I think the only solution that I've discovered so far, and there may be more that you may find, but one that I've discovered is a private approach. And the private approach has some success because, like, for example, the three lady professors, who are full professors, by the way, there's a whole ranking system, but anyways, the three lady professors at the University of Toronto, they reviewed it, and they're in the same department, and they had a discussion because the film gave them the language to discuss this in a comfortable way. It wasn't to discuss evidence, but to discuss how the academic community does not discuss evidence or what are the hindrances there. So it's from a different angle approaching all this. So working with a private approach instills in them the language that they need to discuss this in a comfortable way, provides that foundation. And then they are able to discuss it with other people by giving the film and passing it forward. And that's the only type of success that I'm able to kind of see with this particular community. And by multiplying this model, we can hopefully reach to a much larger group of academics in changing discourse. And perhaps you might be using the word ethos.
Not in a public way. What you mean is not in a way outside of academia, but so that the whole thing gets handled in a strictly academic manner. But not unfairly. You mean not unfairly, but still within the confines of academia, right?
Yeah, but I guess there's a lot to, I think, say here, and often I forget to say what I need to say, but once an issue becomes public, it's seen with in a different light. Let's say the film got big exposure on national television. It probably won't, but let's say it does. Then it becomes a public issue, and when anyone discusses a public issue, the way like discourse works in some type of public forums is one has to take a side to something. And it causes a debate and categorizations take place. Are you left-wing or right-wing? And things like that happen. And that same model has just never succeeded with, especially with super sensitive topics like 9/11. So I'm trying to do, something that does not follow that way of thinking, something to the opposite, that in a very comfortable way allows people to reflect on things rather than taking sides. What they're reflecting on, and if everyone kind of does it, is the film is, the informal thesis of the film is that how did these people fool the academic community? Towards the end of the film, that's pretty much revealed.
How do these people what?
Sorry, what was that?
Repeat your last thing. How do these people what?
How do these people fool the academic community? That's pretty much the informal, more outward thesis that's presented towards the end of the film. And I use that with regards not just to 9/11, but with regards to, let's say, I show General Wesley Clark. Everyone sees that scene where he talks about the classified memo of attacking and destroying 7 Middle Eastern countries, the very countries that are in trouble today.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have academics kind of fooled, talking about the Arab Spring as a natural wave of democracy and things like that, whereas some of it could be constructed artificially. You know, so there are ways that in which academics can be fooled, but the way the film does it seems to be working at a private level that empowers academics to discuss it. I don't know if I can add any further comments.
Right. Thank you very much for that response. That was very clarifying. Okay, we've reached the end of the stack. Does anybody have another question?
Yes, Jim. Jim wanted to.
All right, Jim, I'll put you first on the stack. Who else would like to be back on the stack? Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Well, I think this has been a very valuable and illuminating discussion, and I think Aidan has offered many subtle and perceptive observations, and this is going to be a tremendous benefit when I share it with the others who are, you know, involved in organizing the conference on academic freedom that we're planning for Urbana, Illinois, about which I will keep you abreast. I do think that academicians in a certain way are highly conservative when it comes to complex and controversial issues because they fear more than anything being embarrassed. They don't want the student to ask a question they can't answer. They don't want to be put on the spot about something they don't know. And therefore, they tend to be aversive to any discussion about issues such as those we're so used to addressing. And therefore, I think Adnan's approach is actually quite sensational because it raises the issues to a level where they feel comfortable addressing them, and it doesn't require any specialized knowledge, and they don't feel that they're at risk of being embarrassed. I mean, after all, JFK, 9/11, these other issues are actually very complicated when you get into them, and understanding them adequately requires a lot of research, where most academicians, given the prevalence of the official accounts of these matters, are going to be disinclined to invest time and effort when they think there's low probability that they're going to get a payoff unless they, by some set of circumstances, happen to trip into some findings that make them realize how grotesquely false are the stories we've been told by our own government. So I think all this has been extremely valuable. It's given me a lot to think about, and I'm going to share it with the others. I want to add one more technical philosophical point for Barry because he was talking about Pinker and Chomsky. Chomsky, Fodor, and Pinker all are highly anthropocentric in their approach to the understanding of language, thought, and mind. And in fact, to get a more adequate approach requires a completely different framework, roughly speaking, to put it in a nutshell. They want to take syntax prior to semantics, prior to pragmatics, when in fact something like the opposite approach is really what's required. In fact, I have worked through these issues from an alternative perspective, employing the theory of signs advanced by the only great American philosopher, Charles S. Peirce, which is really the key to understanding the nature of thought. And when you have an adequate framework, you realize it turns out that mind is ubiquitous in nature, so that in my own work, I discuss the evolution of human mentality from the higher primates, from animal mind and all that. So I just mentioned this in passing. I have an introductory book about it entitled Philosophy and Cognitive Science, Second Edition, 1996, and then the more important book, The Evolution of Intelligence, 2005. So I just mentioned this in passing. Since Barry has a special interest in this, I've had encounters with Pinker before, and he has impressed me in a very negative way on several fronts. And regarding Chomsky, I think there's no doubt about his role as a left-wing gatekeeper. He's very good at all the intermediate issues. But when it comes to JFK or 9/11, his position is, if you understand the evidence, completely absurd. I was interviewed twice about Chomsky. You can find them both about YouTube if you just do a search on Fetzer on Chomsky. One's only about 10 minutes long. The other's about 20 or 25. And in both, I expose the illusion that he's a politically responsible individual in relation to these big issues. And also, I discuss to some extent the hopeless inadequacy of his views about language and mind.
Could I add myself to the stack? It's Barry here.
Sure, Barry. Unless you wanted to respond to that. Did you want to respond to Jim's comment?
Yeah, that's what I meant by adding to the stack, and I don't mean to take hardly any time. I very much respect what Jim has just said. And his and Jim may recall one time I interviewed him for TV. We've had a good relationship. The issue of the nature of consciousness and language, and as probably some know, Julian James, in his book on consciousness and the bicameral mind, says that language had to precede consciousness. You couldn't have consciousness without language. And that's the kind of the detailed analysis of the immensely wonderful, awesome nature of the human mind that I love to get into myself. And Jim Fetzer is a person who's right up there in the pantheon on that subject. And I also agree with him about Pinker and Chomsky, because I don't think even at the highest levels of intellectual achievement, that we can rule out that there are people who are, in a word, agents, who have been hired to do the dirty work. They are intellectual psychopaths, I call them. And we only have to think about the history of the CIA. After all, the CIA has been founded by intellectuals. I mean, they practically require that you're a graduate of Harvard or Yale or at least MIT in order to be recruited. And this has been history all along, and that's why they've been so effective with their psychological operations, which is really central to what the CIA has achieved horribly over the years. So that this is what I mentioned earlier to Adnan with respect, that I have a darker view of Pinker. And this would be relevant, and this is the final thing I'll mention, be relevant to this teleconference, is that in fact I believe that intellect is over praised. I mean, I think intellectualism itself is like fire. It can be used to warm a home, or it can be used to burn down a home, and that high intelligence does not guarantee that the possessor of that intelligence will be useful to society. And we only have to look at the number of mathematicians and scientists of all kinds who work in the arms industry thinking up new ways to kill people to really show us very simply that that is the case. So it seems to me that perhaps a not insignificant fraction of the academy is comprised of people. Well, I don't know what I mean by not insignificant fraction. I don't want to put a number on it. If it was, it'd be around 5% of people in the academy who are not authentic. They have been recruited, and they play a role, guided by the CIA, for instance, in undermining true intellectual curiosity and the pursuit of truth, as we would put it in ordinary terms. And as a matter of fact, this is even proven, documented. I'm a member of the Bertrand Russell Society. He's my greatest hero. And the CIA had a London bureau chief that worked assiduously on compromising Bertrand Russell. He worked through Russell's publisher. He managed to have the publisher ask Russell to make changes to his manuscripts. And it had something to do with how Russell became a little too fanatically anti-communist at one point, but then he backed off of that when he really saw through it, that anti-communism was a religion that threatened the future of the world and all that. So the CIA works with intellectuals. I think it recruits them. I think Chomsky was recruited at least in college, which is the typical time the CIA recruits, possibly high school, because they also do that. And I don't know how you marry my kind of skepticism and suspiciousness with true intellectual discourse, which I also respect. I have never found a way to properly marry it. I think perhaps, though Adnan points away, is that you do it privately. I'll assume, apart from the fact that the NSA is vitally interested in this telecon, I'll tell you that for sure. There's stuff that's really valuable for the CIA and the NSA in this particular telecon, and we should be proud of that. But I think that Adnan saying to follow a private route can be very valuable. We know that people just one-on-one can really open their minds and sometimes their hearts and say things and hear things and mull things over that they would never do if there was even a third person present. So I think Adnan is really onto something with the private approach. But, of course, we can't overlook trying to do things publicly as well.
I have a comment. If I could be put on the stack, please. Elizabeth.
Okay. Did you wish to comment? Did you wish to respond to that, Anna, or should we go on to Elizabeth?
I just want to thank Barry, and I hope that our collective approaches to all types of communities, general public, academia, government, all succeed together. I think we need to keep pushing in every direction, and I'm all with you there, Barry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Yes, thanks, Barry. I think I've appreciated your comment, too. I think Snowden this year has been a real game changer in terms of how much the public trusts the government. And he was Time Magazine's second man of the year after the Pope. And the fact that Glenn Greenwald is now starting a whole huge new news corporation with the billionaire owner of eBay, and that will be, I guess that'll be located offshore somewhere because Greenwald lives down in Brazil. And there was a very interesting debate between him and a senior editor of the New York Times. It's online, and it's about the philosophy of what news coverage and journalism actually are. And I think there's just a chance that 9/11 could start making... This is going to be a huge... I think news is going to start changing because everywhere people will be able to see what Greenwald's news agency is doing, almost like Russia Today or Al Jazeera, but possibly with a higher profile in the Western consciousness. And if we could get to some of the... He's got a whole stable of journalists that have been fired or are leaving mainstream media right now. He's developing his stable. And I think using Twitter and other social media that we might be able to get through to some of these people who won't have the same kind of constraints on them that that they had in the past. And I think that there's room for hope there, too.
I'd like to speak to Elizabeth's comment. Would anybody else like to speak to anything?
Robin, on this, after you.
I'll put you behind me, Robin. I'd also like to mention that since we're coming up on an hour and three quarters here, if anybody has any announcements, please get them in. And also, if anybody has any ideas for future special teleconferences, we can open the discussion up to that as well. Otherwise, we can stay on this topic if people prefer. I wish I could share Elizabeth's optimism on this regard, too, regarding Greenwald and the new media project. However, I would encourage everyone to take a skeptical approach to this and listen to what, what's her name? The whistleblower.
Sybille Edmonds?
Thank you. Sybille Edmonds and James Corbett and others have raised some very serious questions that Mr. Greenwald is not answering regarding certain conflicts of interest. So I would encourage everyone to tune into that along the way. Maybe we could have guarded optimism here, but I think it has to be pretty heavily guarded because it looks like this may be another gatekeeping operation in the works. But it's hard to say. It's, the jury's still out on it, so maybe we can hope that Elizabeth is right, but I'm not so sure. Anyway, Robin, you're next.
Yeah, I'm going to speak to two things. One, I concur with what you just said, Jim. There is no question that Assange, okay, and Greenwald and Snowden all, okay, steered completely clear of 9/11 truth. And the facts behind 9/11 are going to lead to Israel and Pakistan and a whole bunch of other places. And there's a whole bunch of people in position who are creating new gates. So... And then I just would like to talk
and reaffirm what Barry had said and give you personal information about academia being compromised. For a variety of reasons, I've had two children get raised by or become educated in their teens by what is known as the preparatory high schools for the Ivy Leagues. They're called Ivy Preps. One went to Columbia, got a doctorate in sociology. One eventually graduated from Harvard. And they're both changed people. They both operate now uncomfortably with me, okay, because they have this attitude of social Darwinism, and of course they and their schools are at the top. There is no question that the sociopaths that end up going into politics, high finance, high corporation, and in some ways into the military are bred in such institutions along with the military academies. So Barry, you are exactly correct. Everybody is correct about Chomsky, okay? And this is to Jim Fetzer in his surprise that Harvard, a professor at Harvard, would reach out and step on somebody. I would like to remind or inform that Alan Dershowitz, who fundamentally runs Harvard, okay, wrote a book called Chutzpah. Norman Finkelstein took him on and wrote a book about Beyond Chutzpah, which basically has instructed Israelis to Jewish Americans to stop using the "you're an anti-Semite" thing. And Dershowitz reached out from Harvard and blocked Finkelstein's tenure, I think, at DePaul. I'm pretty sure that's the school. So yep. This game is rigged there, too. We need to constantly be vigilant about this. And please, Adnan, if you want your DVD and your film to be accepted or presented somewhere in schools, do some guerrilla activism, which is what I'm saying. Put your DVD in little jackets, put the word "free" on it, stick it up the bulletin boards all around campuses. You will be surprised at how underground that'll go. You'll get what you want. That's all.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Anybody else?
I'll just add one further reflection. I think this has been a terrific conversation, and I'm also appalled to learn that Philip Zelikow, of all people, should be the Dean of Graduate Studies at Virginia. I taught as a visiting professor at Virginia twice, and he is just exactly the wrong person to be in that position. His academic area of specialization before he entered the government was the creation and maintenance of political myths, MYTHS, and that, of course, is what he gave us in the 9/11 Commission report, so I'm completely appalled that he should be in that crucial position at perhaps our nation's most distinguished public university.
Wow.
Robin here?
Okay, Robin.
Yes. Just a little affirmation here about my approach about civil informationing. Part of the tenets of what I wrote civil informationing as a modern-day modernizing public activism, and part of it is become our own educators and become our own media. And I'm with the kids. Okay, we're all basically old on this phone call, and the kids just aren't relating to the systems that we're talking about. They're online. You know how many people saw the Loose Change film series? They're out there. They're happening. Just do some guerrilla work and work with the kids, too, in addition.
I agree, Robin. Elizabeth here. And I think there's one sentence I read this morning that sums up the possibility, and that is the will to truth can overwhelm the will to power. And Mandela proved that.
It's happening.
It is. The will to truth can overwhelm the will to power.
Yep.
Well, that is an excellent note on which to conclude this teleconference. I would be remiss in not taking a moment to thank Adnan for spending so much time with us and sharing his thoughts and responding to our issues about the film, and we can only wish him the very best in the film's success. And it's
thank you, Adnan.
Thanks, Adnan.
Brilliant work.
Thank you for organizing all this.
Back, again on the last Wednesday in January, so see you then.
Okay. Well, hey, Ken?
Yes.
Before everybody goes, I do have one thing. I have been writing Max, and I've got a nibble. That's all I can say right now.
Writing what?
Max Massimo Mazzucco.
Massimo Mazzucco?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Very good, very good. Very
okay,
good.
I got a little nibble, and
uh-huh.
It is, and what I'm selling him on, he doesn't want to get on a phone call that just does arguing back and forth. Well, I'm just selling him on the competency of our questions and the kind of like the professorial approach that we take.
I can get Max for you. I'm in touch with him all the time. He's on our panel.
Oh, well, good. Yeah, man. Just say, hey, come on, Max.
Sure. That's
you.
No problem. I Skype with him, too.
Great.
So
yeah.
We're good friends.
Tell him we're going to love him. We do. It's a good film, but it's going to do more work at the questions that it asks than it answers, so it's great.
Encourage him maybe to listen to this teleconference as an example of what we're doing with these teleconferences. And also, if anybody can get a hold of John McMurtry and invite him, I mean, I think he's still...
You know what? This is Barry here, and I was going to ask if I could just add that final note in the dying moments here. That John McMurtry, I think, would be a marvelous contributor or guest here. Would you like me to make an outreach to him?
Barry,
I second
that. I think about a way to get in contact with him so he could do that. That would be excellent. It would really be helpful.
Sure. I'll put out an email to you, Ken, and I don't know, maybe the whole group or whatever, and perhaps draft a 100-word request to him and have people look at the draft, and then I'll tweak it and then send it to him.
Well, I'm personally willing to trust your judgment.
Yeah, Barry, do it yourself.
Yeah.
Go for it. You're Barry's wicker, by the way, in case you've forgotten.
Plenty of details to go with that, man, okay?
Great ball. Great ball.
Okay, good night. Thank you, guys.
Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Great to get out, buddy.
Thanks, Edna.
Thank you.